April 13th, 2015, the last day of the course. So everyone in the course, we've learned that the tools we require in order to free our mind and find happiness that comes from true peace. Not a peace from doing meditation, that temporary type of peace where you're just going to get a busy mind again afterwards. And not the type of happiness that we get from just thinking, where sometimes we think something and feel kind of happy, and sometimes we think something, and of course we don't feel happy from what we thought. We've learned the tools to develop our mind. One of the tools is samatha meditation, in order to make the mind fresh, have rest, and have the energy to practice vipassana. It was something available before the Buddha's time, and there are so many different types of samatha meditation. And it's very public information, samatha. It's something that is available in all, inside and outside of all religions. There are many different thoughts on it, very different techniques, but all of it has to do with being attentive to one thing for an extended period. And it has to be a object that we're happy to be with, and the mind that is attentive to it has to be one that is happy and comfortable as well. In this world, people think, okay, I want to feel some peace inside, and then they try to put the mind into a particular state where it can be less thoughts, be more still. And a lot of people end up just creating stress when they do this, but we have to find the object that is right for us, where we're not controlling, but we're not forcing, but we're just knowing the object in a comfortable way. When our heart is happy to be with the object completely, then the mind won't go anywhere else. It'll stay with where it's happy with. A lot of people think that we practice samadhi or practice samatha so that we can gain happiness. But actually, we have to be happy in order to practice samatha. It's the cause for samatha to arise. In fact, in the deepest levels of samatha, the mind is equanimous. It isn't happy per se in the way that we picture happy. It's a very, very subtle happiness, but it's actually more of a equanimous or indifferent mind at the heights of samatha. The high-quality mind with correct samadhi has a different type of peace. It is happy and peaceful because nothing is able to fabricate it. Nothing is able to fool it. It's not being taken over by any mental formation. So it's completely free in a very genuine way. No one is able to control it. No one is able to force it. He's talking about the samadhi of an enlightened one. The way to arrive at such a place of complete freedom where nothing at all can ever take over the mind ever again, we have to study rupa and nama, or this, put simply, this body and mind, or mental and physical phenomena. We start to see the body moving or breathing, and the mind as a separate thing from the body that observes the body. One day, we will discard this body. Certainly at death, there is only one way that this mind can become truly liberated. A lot of people try all kinds of other ways than this one way. They try to brainwash themselves into a certain way of thinking. They try to suppress the mind until it can't feel anything. They try to create a realm, a happy realm, and try to hold the mind into it. Apunya tisankan means forming negative states. And the other Bali word I missed means forming or creating positive states. It's an old Indian language. But whether we're creating or forming positive states, negative states, or emptiness, it's still creating, it's still forming. But in Buddhism, we just see the truth as it is. And this isn't a method of brainwashing where we are trying to get the mind to believe in a certain way, right? It's impossible to find true liberation by brainwashing, because if we're able to brainwash someone, then it can be that state can deteriorate as well. After a while, they can come out of the brainwashing. It's not permanent. Someone who's able to swim, somebody who's able to ride a bike, we can see that once we're able to do these things after we've practiced, they're actually pretty easy. In the same way, we have to train our mind to, for one that's able to practice Dhamma comfortably, easily. Other religions have helping their community, helping people. They have moral codes. They have different ways that we're supposed to control ourselves and different practices, which all are have an element of samadhi to them. But training in wisdom is a very particular study that's only available in Buddhism. And if we don't study this particular study, then we're not really learning the essence of Buddhism. And it's, we don't study this by interfering or by thinking. We have a body. We feel that this body is here. Everybody else has a body too, but they neglect to look at it. They forget about it all day long. Whenever we're out and looking at this and listening to that and thinking about this, we forget about ourselves. We're interested in the outside world instead of being interested in ourselves, even though we love ourselves more than anything else. Like when we're driving and somebody cuts us off in traffic and we get angry. And what happens is, instead of seeing that we've gotten angry from the cutoff, instead, our mind goes out to the person that cut us off. The thing that tempted us into this anger, or lured us into anger. Or we see a beautiful woman walk by, and we like her. We don't take a look and see that the heart is liking. We forget about our body walking or following her. We're interested about the thing outside. We're interested in the pretty woman. We're not interested in our own heart. When we're thinking, at the moment that we're thinking, we know the content of our thought. Sometimes we don't even know what we're thinking. When we know the story that we're thinking, or we're lost in our imagination, we have a body, but we forget that we do. We have a heart or mind, and we forget that we do. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of mosquitoes in Thailand. Sometimes when we're sitting there thinking, our mind has wandered off and we're deep in our story, we get bit by a mosquito and we don't even know that we got bit. We find out later that, ooh, I'm itchy, I must have got bit. We didn't even notice that a big mosquito came and sucked our blood. We forgot about our body. Whatever happens with the body, we forget about it. And whatever happens with the mind, we forget about. The mind is happy, we don't know it. The mind is unhappy, we don't know it. Sometimes we think of somebody, and then we have hate come up regarding that person. But instead of seeing the heart that has hate in it, what we do instead is we look out at that and start thinking about that person that we hate. We don't come back and see, what is the body like? What is the body? What is the mind like? We're just interested in the story out there. Same with listening to songs or watching a movie, listening to songs. Our mind becomes interested only in the song or the movie and not in our own heart that is involved in it. And similarly, when we're thinking about different stories, and we forget that we have a body. It's almost like we don't have a body anymore because we totally forget about it. And the same is true for the mind. It's like we don't have one because we are completely unaware of it. So we have to come to becoming aware of this body and mind, but we have to do it as much as we can, but not in such a way that we're holding attention, not in such a way that we're forcing it. You see, he's imitating, it's like a robot, people who force it in that way, watching every movement. That is not useful. That's actually a stiff and dull state. We have to have a very natural mind, an ordinary mind that changes all the time. If we're intending to watch the body and the mind just stares at it, holds it still, and the body may move, but the mind won't move. So what we want to do is not interfere. For example, if we're watching the breath, we don't intend to breathe. The body's breathing anyway. We just see that the body is breathing, sense the body's breathing. Right? Not like this. Right? We'll get really tired if we are breathing in some sort of strange way or different way. Right? See, we can get stressed from these types of practices because we're interfering with the natural flow of the breath. We've been breathing our whole lives. So just let it breathe as it normally does. And let the body move as it does normally. Don't force it to be still. Don't force the mind to be still. So our first thing to do is not forget about the body and forget about the mind. If we forget about the body and mind, we'll never be able to learn the truth of them. The next thing is we shouldn't be interfering with the body and mind or trying to control them. If we try to control them, then we won't see the truth of them either. If we want to see the truth, we have to let the body and mind free to do what they do and know what it is that they've done. So one thing that we'll do is become interested in our thoughts or senses. We'll get lost. And then when we're lost, we can't walk the path of wisdom. And also the other side or the other extreme is when we force our attention like this. We work in the walking meditation, for example, holding the body really stiff. We won't be able to see the truth when we're interfering. You notice when we do walking meditation, just a few minutes and we start getting tired and bored. But if we walk shopping, we can do it for hours. When we sit in meditation, you can sit just like this, in a relaxed way. You don't have to sit with crossed legs if you don't want. It's all about the quality of the mind. It has nothing to do with the position of the body. We just want to be in a place where we're not forgetting about the body and mind, and we're not forcing or controlling the body and mind. That is enough. Master Put said that if we're practicing vipassana, we could be in a yoga position. We could be having our head on the ground and our feet up and straight up in the air, and we can still be practicing for wisdom. Okay. Whenever we say, okay, it's time to do meditation, everyone, and then everybody shifts and moves and gets ready, starts to control their body immediately, and so often when you start to control your body, next, you control your mind. So here it is. The mind being totally under control. But don't do that. It's not the real deal. It's fooling yourself. When we've controlled, what do we get? We get a burden. Because after we stop controlling, everything will come back to the way it was before we were controlling. So use a mind that is normal, natural. Just feel within this body and in this mind. The body is moving, and we know so, in a very relaxed way. We'll see that this body and mind are two different things. The body is moving, and the mind is just the watcher. Some people practice like Longpa Tian in these different movements of the hands. Now, some people, they think that, oh, if they think of, oh, wait a minute, I did the wrong step. If we think that we did the steps wrong, and then that's wrong meditation, then we've got it wrong. The importance isn't how many steps or how many movements we do. Or walking doesn't have to have particular steps to it or movements of the foot. Right? People, this is somebody often you'll see walking meditation, keeping their body completely controlled in a very stiff way, and then making the mind stiff as well. Once they've got total control, then they slowly walk. It's just everything's just all stiff and rigid. It's not useful. Everybody smile with a sweet smile. Hey, everybody in the course, you get to go home today. Let's see a nice sweet smile. So we can feel the body is smiling, the body is sitting, the body is breathing. We're not controlling it. We're not controlling the mind either. We're just feeling that the body is there. Being aware of the way that it is and being aware of whatever feelings come up in the heart. For example, happiness is there. We recognize that happiness is there. If there is unhappiness, we recognize that. Anger, we recognize that. Greed, we recognize that. Or busy mind, we recognize that. Depressed, we notice that. Why do we notice these things? The heart is just the observer. We'll see that the body and the mind are two different things. The body and the mind are two different things, and they're not us. The body isn't the mind. So when the body gets sick or the body is in pain, the mind doesn't suffer as a result. It isn't the body. When the body dies, the mind just sees some mass is dying. It's not us dying. It doesn't come in and be attached to it anymore. So we don't suffer as a result of having a body. Watching the mind, one day, watching the mind, happiness and unhappiness come and pass away. All good states come and pass away. All negative states come and pass away. If we keep watching again and again and seeing this again and again and again, we'll see that every single formation that comes up in the mind is temporary. It's just like a guest into our home. A guest in our home stays for a while, and it's a guest. It goes away. And we don't have any... we're not that close to them. We don't have an attachment to them, right? If it's somebody else that we don't love, just a guest, and we don't have any attachment or love to them, when they're sick or when they die, then it's not really a big issue for us, right? But once it's our body or someone that we love's body, then we suffer. See, we're not free. We have all these desires, all these wants that we have in our heart, and we have them all day long. Desires are coming up, wants are coming up, all the time, all different kinds. But we can summarize every single want is related to, we want this body and this mind to be happy, and we don't want these things to be suffering. That's what it all comes down to. Why do we watch a movie? We want the mind to be happy. When we feel sort of sad or bored, we want to go drink alcohol. Why do you think we want to go drink alcohol? We want the mind to be happy. Why do we go to the doctor? We want the body to be happy and comfortable. Right? So every single want that we have always comes back to, we want this body to be happy and free from suffering. We want this mind to be happy and free from suffering. But if we're able to see the truth that this body is something that is always suffering, standing is suffering, sitting suffering, lying down suffering, if we truly understand that the body is a total mass of suffering, then the mind won't attempt to try to make it comfortable, won't try to gain any happiness from making it comfortable anymore. It'll be free of the bondage of attachment to the body. Notice people that are old. If they've never practiced, then they suffer so much as they're getting old and dying. Some people, another example, we have a neighbor and we hate our neighbor. And instead of realizing that life or that this it's suffering, what we do is we run away from the neighbor, we go move somewhere else. And then what happens? Well, we haven't dealt with the karma of that situation, so we end up with another bad neighbor, or that bad neighbor moves into our neighborhood. So Dhamma is something very ordinary. Everything is ordinary. Right? So when we have a guest in our home, even if the guest is not a good guest, we see that it's something that is just going to leave soon. We don't struggle with it. We don't waver with it. It doesn't, with the fully developed mind, it doesn't even matter if a flood is going to flood the whole world. There isn't any wavering or struggle in the heart regarding this. Those that have a lot of regret or remorse, there's a lot of suffering. And some people say, oh, everything is suffering, everything is suffering. And if they're just thinking about it, then they may feel regret about this or sad or depressed about this, right? But this isn't a true practitioner. This is just somebody thinking. If you actually practice and see that everything that arises falls away, and everything is suffering, that actually the heart is very happy and expansive because it is free of this. When the mind is not attached to the heart or to what happens in the heart or to the body. Buddhadasa said, our tongue is in our mouth. I want to try to follow this. So, snakes have fangs, but they don't bite their own tongue. And their tongue is very venomous. Or wait a minute, their fangs are venomous, but they don't bite their own tongue. So the tongue of a snake has poisonous fangs, but he can't bite his own tongue or he'll die, right? It's like the snake is living with suffering right there. This poison is right inside the snake, but the snake is not affected by the poison. So that's an analogy to, we live with this body and mind which are suffering, but the enlightened mind lives with them in such a way that doesn't suffer as a result of that. So the principle is, be aware of this body and mind, see them working, but with a mind that is comfortable, that is impartial and doesn't interfere. When happiness comes up in the heart, we just know that it's there. We don't interfere with it. We don't try to make this happiness stay really long or learn, okay, how is it that I can keep getting this happiness? We don't interfere with it. When suffering arises in the heart, we don't think, we just know in a way with not interfering, not hating it, trying to push it away. We need a heart that is equanimous, that isn't liking and wanting more of this, or hating and disliking and wanting less of that. Not interfering, but just seeing the truth of everything come and go. Because we have bias, we are not able to be equanimous. So we're trying to see in an unbiased way, without liking or disliking what happens, just see the way the body and mind are. But when we do have liking and disliking come up, we don't resist it or reject it, because we can't reject it, it's there. The truth of non-self means that we can't control, we can't order the mind to be the way we want it, we can't order the body to be the way that we want it. We can't order the body to not get hot, not get cold, not get thirsty. The body, the mind, we can't force it to don't suffer, you know, be happy all the time. We can't suffer these things. We can't control these things. So we look in such a way, we see in such a way, but that we don't interfere. So if something comes up, like happiness, and we like it, then know that the mind is liking. The liking will disappear once mindfulness sees it. Because the liking has a greed invested in it, that's an impurity. And when mindfulness sees a defilement or an impurity, then the impurity disappears, because mindfulness and unwholesome states, like impurities, can not exist in the same mental moment. So the eyes, ears, nose, mouth, body make contact with the world, and then whatever we make contact with, we like it or we don't like it. We see the liking, we see the disliking regularly. Soon mindfulness will come in and the liking and disliking will disappear. Equanimity will be achieved. Some of us, when we practice meditation, we can make the mind really nice and still and content. And then what do they do when they come out of this meditation? They come out and they think, oh wow, I'm a good meditator, that was great, you know. And they end up with a big ego that believes that it's able to control things rather than seeing the truth that things are actually not ultimately under our control. So it doesn't gain the true wisdom. When we come out of a stillness meditation, there's an art to it. If we come out of it too quickly, then we may have a headache. It may be too drastic, the difference. But the truth is that mindfulness is something that meditation is something that deteriorates. It has the nature of deteriorating. So sometimes we'll have a good meditation, sometimes we'll have a bad meditation. It isn't something we can rely on or depend on. Some samatha is amazing. Some people can sit for a week without moving, without eating, without drinking, without breathing, and they still live through it. But we'll think that we're amazing if we can do that, and we'll think that things can be controlled if we do that. We'll have a wrong understanding. The next minute we could get up after that week of complete stillness and get hit by a car. So maybe things can't be controlled. Come out of meditation. See, even these wonderful meditators, they can't do it all the time. And they can't truly control how it's going to be. It's just fooling yourself if you think that you can control things. So come to see the truth of the body, truth of the mind, with an ordinary mind and a mind that isn't interfering. This is the principles of practicing wisdom. When we notice, when we practice watching the body, we can see it in real time. We can have a relaxed, comfortable mind. We don't notice with a rigid or stiff mind like this. Like the dummies on the sides of the dummies on the sides of the streets that are waving people into their shops. Right? This is a useless kind of a thing to do. Just practice in a happy, content way. You laugh and see the body laughing, the body standing, sitting, lying down, see it doing so, see the body eating, see the body going to the toilet. See that it isn't us. See in a relaxed, comfortable way. You can see the body in real time, right in the present. But the mind, we can't see in the immediate present, because the mind has to have emotions and mental states come in first before we're able to recognize that it's there. So while we're greedy, while we're angry, we won't be able to see it. There won't be true mindfulness that comes up. Mindfulness will come up after the greed or anger has arisen. The Buddha taught bhikkhus, when the mind has craving, know that it has craving. You see, it has to have craving first, and then we know it. But if we were angry yesterday, and then we know today, that's too long, that's too far away. It has to be quite close to the moment that it actually happens. So there's no way that we can be greedy and continue to be greedy and continue watching it. It comes after. The knowing or mindfulness comes after. Watching the body happens right in this moment. But watching the mind or heart is the moment, the complete next, the next moment from the moment, from the present moment. Mm-hmm. There isn't. So it's the immediate next moment. If we have too many things in the middle, if there's too big of a space between the amount of time that we're greedy or angry and the time that we know the greed or the anger, then that's not the practice. That's too late. But if it can come up and then we can know it quite quickly, that's useful. So keep practicing. And we'll be able to accept the truth. Right now, our minds do not accept the truth. We'll see that whether the mind or body is suffering or happy is not something that we can control. We still think that these things are, at least, are primarily under our control. And that's why we suffer, and that's why we don't have enlightening wisdom right now. Where is suffering? Suffering is in the five aggregates. But suffering will always be there. But the mind cannot be involved in it at all. It can be in a state where it knows these things are suffering, but isn't attached to any of them. So there was a time when Lompa was practicing and he could notice the things going on in his heart and his mind would move towards it. He would see that and then the mind would move back and be the watcher, and then it would go back again into the next states that would come up and go back again to the watcher. So there was the mind, there was what was going on in the mind, and then all of a sudden the mind just dropped out. and wasn't holding anything. It wasn't holding to the watcher. It wasn't holding to any mental formations. And he was certain that must have been nirvana. So then he ended up, he didn't intend to, but he ended up going to see a great master named Bunjan. He was actually just at a seminar from work, and everybody was, it was the evening, and everybody was starting to drink and party, and he didn't want to be there for that. So he went to a temple called Santitam, and it was nearby. And he figured, well, maybe I'll just go do some meditation instead. So he walked in. A monk came up to him and said, oh, Master Bunjan is here. Said that to Longpa when he was a layman. And Longpa said, I don't know that master. That's okay. No, thank you. And he actually knew that there was an abbot there named Tongyin, and he knows him, and he was going to go to say hello and pay his respects. So he asked this monk that came running to him to tell him that Master Bunjan is there. He said, I want to go see Ajahn Tongyin. So this monk conceded and brought him there. So he sat there with Ajahn Tongyin for a while. It was late by now and cold. That monk was still waiting for me. He said, Master Bunjan is here. You have to go see him. It's once in a very long time that he'll actually come. Yeah, it seemed as if he was begging, just sort of like in an old Chinese movie, would just sit, stand there on his knees for hours until I concede. So he said, okay, I'll go see this master. He was on a... It was just a little kuti, a little hut with a little balcony. And he went up the stairs. And then that monk that escorted me there ran back to his room. And I was there alone with this master, Bunjan. He saw me and he was laying down, but he sat up, pointed to me and says, and didn't even say hello. He just said, so how is it that you practice? So Longpa at the time, he said, I'm not holding to the watcher, and I'm not holding to the formations. So Master Bunjan said, what kind of nirvana has an entrance and an exit? And didn't really understand what he was saying. I think maybe we just had a different accent or a different way of talking, so maybe I thought he didn't understand what I said. So I said it again. You see, my mind isn't attaching to the watcher, and it's not attaching to the mental formations. You see, it's not interfering. You see, that means that it's not interfering with anything. I thought I was in nirvana. Mm-hmm. So I told him again. The second time, this time, he yelled it. What kind of nirvana has an entrance and an exit? He was shocked. And he realized that, oh, he's right. There's still a coming in and out of this. It can't be nirvana. It's not the real thing. It's a fake. It's a phony. It's just another subtle type of samatha. Do you know the name of this type of samatha? The samatha that doesn't attach to anything, doesn't hold... that doesn't hold to... The mind watching doesn't hold to any formations. He's not going to say the mind of it. He says it's not the name of it. It's not polite to do so. So you can find the name for yourself. Then he laughed and laughed and laughed. The Master Bunjan, when after he shocked Longpa, and so Longpa didn't really think anything was funny, but he laughed anyway, just being kind because the teacher was laughing. And then all of a sudden, as he was laughing and laughing, Ajahn Bunjan was laughing, then he just stops. Yeah, just like there's no waves in the ocean. And so then I stopped. And then he says, good. Your practice is good. Now you can go. And that's it. what an amazing master that was. Never knew him, but he obviously sent a monk to come, and he knew that I was coming, and he says, make sure that this man that comes in comes to see me. When he finally ordained as a monk, in his fourth year as a monk, a man came to him once and said, I'm here to learn with you. Master Bunzhen asked me to come. And he says, but Master Bunzhen died years ago. He said, yes, but he told me on what year and where it is that I'm supposed to go and learn the Dhamma. He told me that. Told him, I missed how many years beforehand, but years beforehand. An amazing monk indeed. And so I was able to help this man and teach him. Everything, meditation has an entrance and an exit, but nirvana has no entrance and no exit. It's right here, eternal and always in front of us, but our minds are just not of a high enough quality to see it. We're still a slave.